Will Palm Beach County be an AI rights leader? Can Little Havana make Calle Ocho pedestrian friendly? And is college football at UM and across America just a charade? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going to look at a citizen revolt brewing in Palm Beach County against those massive AI or artificial intelligence data centers. Water waste, noise, and big power bills. We'll also examine why a decade-old plan to create less driving and more walking along Miami's iconic Calle Ocho in Little Havana is still in limbo. And after the Hurricanes championship bid here this week, we'll ask, is there really such a thing as college football anymore, or just money? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. AI, or artificial intelligence, is of course the promising new tech of our time. As a learning, medical, and industrial tool, it's a wondrous development. But its downsides are heavy too. For starters, loss of human input and human jobs. But another drawback is getting lots of attention these days, and it impacts water resources, quality of life, and our electric bills. I'm talking about those massive AI data centers that drive the AI revolution. And folks in Palm Beach County are leading the charge to say, not so fast. At a county commission meeting last month, residents blasted a proposal called Project Tango to build an enormous AI data facility near Wellington and Loxahatchee. And the commission has now postponed the project. Those residents, meanwhile, seem to have a powerful ally, Governor Ron DeSantis, who has proposed a citizen AI Bill of Rights, even as President Trump tries to bar states from regulating AI. Now, Palm Beach County looks like a national nexus of the AI data center drama. We'd like to hear your thoughts, too. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, who's been following the recent AI anger up there. Wilkin, how are you?
Hey, Tim. Good to see you.
What exactly is Project Tango, this AI data center they want to build on 200 acres out in West Palm Beach County? And when I say they, who exactly is they?
Yeah, they. Well, the Palm Beach County Zoning Board recommended approval on December 4th, 2025, not final approval, of a proposal allowing about 1.8 million square feet of data center
Whose
space.
Proposal is this, though? Who wants to build this?
And so this applicant is PBA Holdings.
Okay.
It's basically an ownership group that owns a commercial development site in the Loxahatchee area where Project Tango would be built. Mm-hmm. And so the stakeholders are not publicly well-known, and they aren't tied to big tech like OpenAI or Google,
right.
Google, but they're well known in real estate circles.
Mm-hmm. So let's stop here for a second and remind folks why these AI data centers have to be so large and require such large quantities of resources like water and electricity.
Yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, AI data centers rely on heavy computing and racks of specialized chips like GPUs, which use huge amounts of electrical power and generate a lot of heat. And that heat, Tim, must be cooled down somehow. Mm-hmm. And the servers also require large amounts of power equipment and cooling infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could think about on a micro scale, your computer, for example, it's installed with a fan to cool it down.
Yeah.
And guess what? Some of this AI cooling infrastructure often takes up as much space as the data center buildings themselves, and the centers can have negative environmental and health impacts.
Okay.
Yep.
That's where the crux of this dispute
Absolutely.
Then comes in. And as I said, that then is why the Palm Beach County residents out there near Wellington and Loxahatchee are so strongly opposing this 200-acre AI data center project. Let's listen to how Loxahatchee resident Corey Canterman put it at that county commission meeting you attended last month.
No good comes of having an AI data center near you. Put them in the location of least impact to the environment and people. This location is not it.
Okay, that's a pretty definitive statement there
on
his part. Wilkin, walk us through, though, the litany of objections that Mr. Kanteman and residents out there have to Project Tango, including the perceived noise issue, which I think a lot of people haven't really heard a lot about.
Yeah, these residents have been quite forthright. One even told me, this is not a dance. This isn't traditional tango.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why do they name this the Tango Project?
To make it sound appealing, my assumption. And so, you know, residents in rural Laxahatchee and Wellington, like many communities across the country, actually, worry about electrical energy. We're talking in the hundreds of megawatts if this is fully built out. Then there's low frequency noise, like you mentioned earlier, that can disrupt sleep. Water consumption, of course, is a huge issue used to cool down those servers that I explained earlier.
Right.
You have the potential for the generation of carbon dioxide because AI drives up data center power demand, much of which still comes from fossil fueled plants that emit CO2. All of these concerns are fueling this out.
Outrage. And thanks for reminding us of the environmental aspect. Not just the water usage, but the fact that we tend to forget that along with this massive requirement for electrical power comes a massive requirement for the kind of fossilized fuel source that you're talking about that could create more environmental problems.
And in this incorporated area in the western part of Palm Beach County, a lot of those folks moved out there because it's rural.
Right.
Poses a lot of issues.
Why then do the Palm Beach County Commission and AI advocates like, again, the name is PBA Holdings? Why do they feel, though, that this data center project is the appropriate thing to do in this particular place out there? I know they feel it would be a job creator, for instance. And I know Palm Beach County in general is experiencing a big economic boom these days that includes AI. Why are they pushing this out there?
I mean, private entity is going to try to push whatever project if they can get away with it on the governmental level. I mean, it's all about money, of course.
Right.
And so supporters argue this would expand an existing industrial park and point to projections of billions of dollars in economic impact and jobs, you know, high wage facility jobs and construction jobs.
Okay, because that industrial park already exists out there, they're saying, well, no, it is appropriate to put it out there, whereas the residents are saying, no, it's not appropriate for this. So that there's a big disconnect there.
A huge disconnect. And that specific area is what is referred to as a developmental zone.
Right.
So that's the go-to, right?
Okay.
But also supporters argue that many years ago, the site, like you said earlier, was already approved for warehouses. And a conventional data center. And that's a distinction we want to make sure we put out there, that there are differences between what a conventional data center was back then versus now.
Are the advocates, though, saying things like, well, we have to put these out in those rural areas because of the nature of the beast that you and I have just been talking about, and not in more urban areas? Centers these things have to go out in those less populated, more rural areas like this.
Yeah, and that's a fair argument, but that's in theory versus in practice. And as you and I know, we've had a huge housing crisis where residential developments are being built more out west, and so that clash is going to continue from years on out.
Good point.
And so the project team also said that they're going to conduct noise studies, cooling plans, and design tweaks that can limit all of the residents' concerns about health and environmental safety, but residents just aren't buying it.
And so why then do you think the commission ultimately backed down last month in Palm Beach County and voted unanimously to postpone Project Tango?
You played that clip earlier.
Yeah.
You saw the passion in that guy's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And when I interviewed him, it was a sustained passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of sustained passion I felt and saw across the board. Let's just say the weight of public pressure got too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Point blank. There were huge concerns about transparency because it was initially placed on the consent agenda, which is typically reserved for routine government matters.
Mm-hmm.
And often does not require the same level of public input as the regular agenda.
Uh-huh.
And so residents were absolutely furious that the project moved forward under the code name Project Tango and on an accelerated timeline, which of course left people feeling blindsided and without enough information to make an informed decision. And so all of that resulted in a massive petition supported by those particular residents with more than 8,000 signatures. And Tim, in December, after hours of, you know, heated comments from more than 50 residents, county commissioners unanimously postponed the project.
Right. So the old saying, it takes two to tango, and they were saying, you don't have us.
Can't even dance
to
anymore.
That's right. Now, in your reporting, you also, though, spoke with an AI expert, Nick Sinaramis, who is director of the University of Miami's Frost Institute for Data Science and Computing. And he seemed to urge understanding of both sides in this dispute. Here's what he told you is what he feels is probably the key point in this issue.
So the noise, it would be, to be honest with you, something that it can be manageable, and it depends on how close you are, because there is insulation and so forth. I think the primary concern, I would say, that anyone should have is the electricity grid big enough to support this. And of course, in Florida, we have hurricanes and so forth. What does it mean in terms of the resilience?
So he seems to be saying, Wilken, that the noise from these AI data centers can be managed. But when it comes to the massive amounts of electricity these things have to devour, the power grid situation in South Florida and Florida in general may not be able to accommodate that demand without jacking up our FPL bills even higher than they already are these days?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's the case he's making, maybe even indirectly. If you recall, I mean, Hurricane Ian was absolutely devastating in the western part of the state.
Right.
So just imagine something like that hitting, you know, a rural area in South Florida. And so he obviously values tech innovation and the potential economic benefits, but argues that data centers are not inherently bad if built properly. The primary concern, he says, is whether the electricity grid is big enough to support the center and whether it's resilient enough during a potential
hurricane.
Well,
what does he say the solution is then? Is it up to the FPL, or who is it up to then to enlarge our power grid to accommodate these kinds of centers?
From his perspective, as an AI expert, obviously he leans on elected officials making the policy suggestions and approvals to see how that can pan out from now. Since there aren't any statewide guardrails, that's a topic that's happening right now on the state level. I'm sure we'll get to that soon.
Yeah.
But all he can speak to is the functioning aspect of the AI data center. Policy-wise, that's a completely different conversation.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilken Brutus about the growing challenge in Palm Beach County to a proposal for a massive AI data center there. And it reflects how it reflects the growing state and national AI angst. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Wilken, I want to turn now to the other intriguing facet of this controversy, which is the support these Palm Beach County residents who oppose this AI data center seem to have in the person of none other than Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. As I mentioned at the outset, President Trump, who's a big AI advocate, obviously, has warned the states to stay out of AI regulation. DeSantis, however, insists states have to have some control, and he's even proposed what he calls a, quote, citizen AI Bill of Rights. What aspects of AI does DeSantis feel needs state regulation, and does that include these AI data centers?
Yeah, that's one of the through lines I've noticed with covering the story, is that residents and even the governor feel as though this is going across party lines, that this isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. It's a survival issue. It's a resource issue. It's a sustenance issue. And so that's intriguing. Governor DeSantis, during a roundtable discussion in December, warned against the state government subsidizing large AI data
centers. And that was a conference up in FAU, right?
Yes, and he cites, again, heavy demands on water and power. And quite frankly, he cited most of what local residents in the western part of Palm Beach County fear, and argues that data centers near residential areas drain local resources with little economic impact or benefit.
Right. Now, this sort of shows how DeSantis, despite his sort of arch conservative reputation, does have is more attuned to the environmental issues that Floridians obviously tend to care about.
Yeah. I mean, he won. That's what drove his first term, correct?
Right. Yeah. Now, and I understand that legislation has actually been filed in the state legislature for the current session to protect communities, as it says, from AI expansion projects like this. What does it lay out?
Right. So There are multiple bills that were put forth, actually, to mm-hmm. basically help prevent residents from subsidizing the electric power and water consumption costs right. of these hyperscale AI data
by
centers.
By paying much higher bills.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And we're talking up in the hundreds,
yeah.
Particularly. And so the state bills essentially help protect the grid. One particular bill, HB 1007, is trying to push those AI projects to pay their own way. Mm-hmm. And also it requires additional public discourse and hearings for water use permits.
Sounds it sounds a lot like the kind of, you know, infrastructure bills, you know, when you demand that developers pony up the cost for a lot of the infrastructure that's going to be involved in it. Sounds like it's sort of the same nature.
Yeah, that's the same mechanism. You're okay. absolutely right. And I think, of course, this is going through the legislative body right now. Uh-huh. And these are the types of guardrails that is going to be implemented on a state level. We'll see right. how that is effective on a local level. Mm-hmm. But that is specifically what residents here are calling for.
Now, I know this Project Tango AI Data Center is not the only AI concern in Palm Beach County. As I mentioned, we're seeing an economic boom in places like West Palm Beach, especially, which is being called Wall Street South. And it's bringing in big companies that may have big AI needs, which in turn raise the kinds of concerns like inordinate electricity use that's causing anxiety elsewhere. Should folks up there be concerned beyond just this Project Tango issue?
Yeah, that's a fair question for elected officials in West Palm Beach who should be transparent about how fast or how slow local rules catch up with tech and finance growth, which can indirectly require demand for more electrical infrastructure.
Yeah.
So even if there aren't any data centers in downtown West Palm Beach, those companies are still going to require a lot of power.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the growth of, quote, Wall Street South offices doesn't necessarily mean West Palm will be surrounded by Project Tango-style AI data centers.
Right, right.
But the transparency part is the most important part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So finally, Wilkin, where do things stand now with Project Tango after the Palm Beach County Commission postponed it last month? What comes next in this AI struggle?
Well, in our conversation, since we've established that it is not a dance,
right?
Project Tango, this AI data center project in the western part of Palm Beach County, is currently in limbo while county staff conducts additional analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And county commissioners delayed a final decision until a new hearing set on April 23rd
in April,
of this
right.
year,
this 2026. This is a zoning meeting.
This is
right?
a zoning yeah. meeting, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's public. It's not okay. on a consent agenda this time, right?
Okay.
And as you can imagine, the outrage has intensified. And so I expect yet another very intense public debate.
We'll wait for it. Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilkin, many thanks as always, sir.
Merci, Tim.
Still to come, can Little Havana make Calle Ocho more walkable again? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. And just a reminder that next Friday, our program will air live from the Little Haiti Cultural Center in Miami as we devote the show to the TPS crisis our important Haitian community may be facing next month. There's no doubt that Miami's iconic Calle Ocho, that stretch of Southwest 8th Street that runs through Little Havana, is enjoying a boom these days. Legions of bust-in tourists, in fact, have made it a sort of Cuban culture theme park. But for many locals, that's also created a problem. They feel Calle Ocho today is less pedestrian-friendly, which can mean less family-friendly. And amid all the commercialism, it's lost some of the exile community charm that Little Havana's main thoroughfare was once known for. Which is why there's an effort afoot to revive a so-called Calle Ocho Revitalization Plan, which was first presented back in 2015. It reimagines Calle Ocho as the more walkable strip with a narrower street and wider sidewalks, dedicated bike and bus lanes, and safer crosswalks. The question is whether the City of Miami and the Florida Department of Transportation, which 11 years ago seemed enthusiastic about the Calle Ocho plan, will finally initiate some action on it. This month, WLRN senior producer Sherry Lynn Cabrera aired an engaging report on the Calle Ocho plan, which we'd like to let you listen to again here.
If you've ever walked along Little Havana's Calle Ocho, or 8th Street, you might find these sounds familiar. There's the salsa booming out of restaurants. The dominoes being shuffled around as mostly older Cuban residents prepare for another game at Domino Park. There's, of course, the roosters. And there's one sound that's always there in the background, the constant flow of car traffic. Three lanes of one-way traffic.
If you look at any section in Miami, the amount of space given to the car is far greater than anything else, with some exceptions, of course.
That's Juan Mullerat, principal of the urban planning and design firm Plaserbia. More than 10 years ago, he and his wife, Megan McLaughlin, who is Plaserbia's office director, lived just blocks away from Calle Ocho.
And we had two small children, so we were walking around with the double stroller a lot, and we were loving the urban life and the culture and the community that we were experiencing there, walking to get our coffee in the morning and getting an empanada or, you know, a croqueta for breakfast. But we were concerned by, you know, safety. No matter how young or old you are, walking along Calle Ocho, that we really could see that there was improvements needed.
The couple and the firm would embark on a years-long project to reimagine what 8th Street could look like with a more pedestrian-friendly atmosphere.
We used the resources available through Plaserbia to work with the business owners that were going to be directly affected by any changes to Calle Ocho and to create images of what could Calle Ocho look like in an ideal future.
That vision includes Calle Ocho as a two-way, two-lane road, returning the vibrant strip back to how it was before the late 1960s. Sidewalks would be much wider, and there would be dedicated bike and bus lanes. Crosswalks would also be wider.
It so happened that at the same time, FDOT started a study to look at how the mobility was working on Calle Ocho. And we began to be involved in both a community-led master planning effort that was for the entire Little Havana, as well as become advocates of the community, working with FDOT and the City of Miami and the county to ensure that whatever was proposed for Calle Ocho would become something that would be up to par to what Calle Ocho really means to Miamians.
When Plaserbia unveiled its Calle Ocho revitalization plan in 2015, Miami City Commissioners praised it as a bold vision for the future of one of Miami's most famous streets and tourist destinations. City officials even went so far as to declare a day for the firm on November 19 of that year. So, what happened? Since the introduction of the master plan over a decade ago, the city has not picked up or signed off on any major changes to Little Havana's 8th Street. The Florida Department of Transportation, or FDOT, completed its study in 2022, but the agency told WLRN it did not move forward with some of the findings after input from the public and stakeholders. It did address some of the safety and operational concerns that were identified in the study. FDOT installed pedestrian curb ramps and pedestrian detectors and push buttons along Southwest 8th Street. Pedestrian signals and signage were also upgraded. But Calle Ocho continues to be dominated by car traffic.
It's very difficult to make impactful modifications to a right-of-way that carries that much traffic. It's a major thoroughfare. FDOT added some safety measures for crossing on Calle Ocho. You know, these kinds of projects, which ultimately are engineering projects, need to come from a larger, more contextual understanding of the entire area. It would be worthwhile now, 10 years after, to revisit those plans and understand where we are today compared to back then and see if those plans and that implementation has worked.
More than a decade later, the issues that first motivated the Calle Ocho revitalization plan are even more urgent today.
By no means do we want to imply that Calle Ocho should be entirely pedestrian. But if we're honest with ourselves, that's how you experience great streets on foot. You don't experience them by car. But Calle Ocho needs to be balanced. It needs to have a balanced section that allows for people with a double stroller, people with wheelchairs as well, to be able to walk down the street and experience Calle Ocho. The street has become alive. And it has been the efforts of small business owners and entrepreneurs. It's incredible the variety of people that are on the street almost 24/7. But I think that the locals have already realized, and I think that government, federal, state, and local, they're beginning to realize that we have a real gem in Cayocho, and it's just a matter of polishing that gem to really make it not just the heart, but the most important avenue or street or thoroughfare in the city of Miami. Most of us think of Cayocho as a tourist destination because that's what makes it famous. But we cannot forget that Cayocho is Little Havana's commercial core. And as Little Havana's commercial core, there are certain services and local businesses that are servicing the larger community of locals.
So what has communication been like with the city now, 10 years later?
Miami is always on the move, but it is also always on the move in terms of development. And so there is so much going on. And for good or for bad, we're always looking at what's happening next. And so because there's so many projects moving so fast, city staff and officials, they're always looking at where is the next investment coming from? How can we add more housing? How can we improve traffic? So working with the city in order to move the master plan forward is always difficult. You always need a champion, and you need that champion to stick with you for the longest possible period of time. Planning and politics are always at odds with each other. We work on a 40-year lifespan of a project to get implemented. So we're looking at visions that are way beyond anybody in power can be behind. The types of projects that we're currently working with the city on, and we're working very closely with them on other projects, are very much in line in terms of the vision and in terms of the objectives with the Little Havana Master Plan. Now, we're doing all these things in other parts of the city, so I can tell you with quite a lot of certainty that if the same objectives can apply to Little Havana, we just need a good champion in power. It's time to reconsider those recommendations that we put. There are hundreds of recommendations in that report. Things have changed, and it's definitely time to reinvest.
That was Juan Muyerat and Megan McLaughlin. They work for the urban planning and design firm Placerbia. You can find this story and some of the renderings of the master plan at WLRN.org. I'm Sherry Lynn Cabrera, and this is WLRN News.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You just listened to a report by WLRN's Sherry Lynn Cabrera on a plan to make Miami's iconic Calle Ocho less car-heavy and more walker-friendly. Call us with your thoughts at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN senior producer Sherry Lynn Cabrera. Sherry, thanks for that great report. You really took us to Calle Ocho there.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you think we're seeing a growing interest in the Little Havana community now to resurrect, as it were, this Calle Ocho revitalization plan? What's pushing the effort to get these recommendations back on track?
What's pushing the effort really now is Placerbia. It's been more than a decade at this point since the plan was first introduced. And it was actually one of their longest projects ever, they told me, because it involved a lot of research and conversations with the community. But for them, it's really that Calle Ocho has changed tremendously in just 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's obvious even just walking on Calle Ocho that there's just so many tourists, but locals too. I myself have gone to Calle Ocho several times recently for dinner and to meet up with friends. So I think that it's become more than just a tourist destination. There's lots of new restaurants, bars, coffee shops.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the new, you know, Ball and Chain.
Yeah,
Of the other, I think one of the places around there was just voted one of the best bars in Miami, right?
Exactly. And They're owned by locals. So There's new condominiums, new housing. So Placerbia, they feel the same way about 8th Street, and they're trying to get momentum back up about this plan 10 years later because of the fact that even though the environment of Calle Ocho has changed, the street itself has not.
Right. Tell us a little more, though, about this urban planning firm, Placerbia, and the married couple who helped direct it and lived there near, and still do live there, right, near Calle Ocho, Juan Muyerat and Megan McLaughlin. Is their feeling that Calle Ocho should be more family-friendly and perhaps a little less tourist and car-friendly representative of the larger residential community there, do you think?
Yeah, so Pliserbia, they do a lot of work with cities and municipalities to create these master plans, and they help cities figure out their mobility and housing needs, but they also do pro bono work, like this Calle Ocho plan, where they themselves, without developers and the city on board, decided to create this new vision of 8th Street. But Juan and Megan, like you said, they lived near Calle Ocho and have lived in South Florida for decades now.
Right.
But they consider themselves locals. And with the Calle Ocho plan specifically, they told me it was very important that they got it right. So it involved a lot of community engagement and conversations. They had community meetings at Robert King High Park, which is on West Flagler Street, a couple blocks away from 8th Street, where locals shared their ideas and concerns. And Juan and Megan actually told me about a group of older residents who they affectionately nicknamed Las Viejitas de Calle Ocho, which translates to the old ladies
old
of 8th
ladies,
Street.
Right.
But this group of elderly women, they had no car. They got around everywhere by foot. They shared their experience just going to the nearby pharmacy. They didn't feel safe having to cross some of the streets or intersections, including 8th Street.
Right.
Nearby 7th Street, which is very residential, is also a huge concern and a very dangerous street to cross till this day. So Little Havana locals, they simply just want safer, more family-friendly streets.
That's understandable. But what are some of those Calle Ocho plan's recommendations that you think have the best chance of seeing some action now from Miami and the Florida Department of Transportation? Is it to turn the street back into two lanes, make the sidewalks wider? What do you think has the best chance of sort of coming to the forefront?
Tim, it's really hard to tell because Pliserbia told me that they haven't really had conversations with the city for a while about this particular plan. And same goes with the Florida Department of Transportation. I mentioned it in my story, but the agency did in the last couple of years install some crosswalks and updated some pedestrian signage. This is after they conducted a study about mobility there, but that's pretty much it. And when I reached out to the agency for this story, they told me that the department does not have any additional studies planned for the area. But it's important to note that the Department of Transportation in general tends to be more car-centric. And as for the city of Miami, Juan and Megan, they're hopeful that the city officials might have renewed interest in the plan, but it's really all up in the air at this point.
And I noticed in your report there was one recommendation that one of the crosswalks be painted like a Domino's, you know, to reflect Domino's Park. But that would seem to run up against the Governor Ron DeSantis' state law that you can't do something like that with a crosswalk.
Exactly.
But what about Eileen Higgins, the new mayor? I mean, she's obviously very attuned to the Hispanic community. She speaks fluent Spanish. She knows Little Havana particularly well. Do you think maybe this has a better chance under her mayoralty to come to realization?
I think lots of people are hopeful. I think Juan and Megan, like it's mentioned in my report, politics runs in a 4-year cycle, and we have a new administration. So I think they're hopeful.
Okay. Now, one of the things that strikes me about Little Havana today is that it's not really the Cuban community anymore that we used to think of it as. A lot of that core Cuban exile population has actually moved out of Little Havana, and other groups, especially Nicaraguans and other Central American communities, have moved in. Is there a feeling that perhaps there's a bit of a disconnect between that Cuban culture theme park that's emerged on Calle Ocho today, as I mentioned before, and the actual Little Havana community that resides there now?
So I can't speak for Pliserbia or Little Havana residents, but I can speak on what I have observed. And I will say, yes, there is a little bit of a disconnect because there is a huge Central American population in Little Havana. I myself have Honduran family in Little Havana. And they do go to Calle Ocho regularly to shop, and some of them work there. So I do feel like we're not acknowledging that part of the population in Little Havana, the section of 8th Street that is very vibrant with Cuban culture. I mean, I think it's safe to say that it is very much catered to tourists, but I think that locals sometimes also embrace it. I actually went to Calle Ocho recently, and I was in that particular touristy part, and I went into Domino Park. And I was happy to see that there are still Cuban locals there playing dominoes. And I did buy a cortadito at a nearby Cuban restaurant.
Of course.
And I'm not Cuban.
You got to go to a Ventanita, sure.
Yeah, of course. And I'm not Cuban, but I did spot other locals there. And we were embracing it. So I'm interested to see how Little Havana and Calle Ocho evolve 10 years from now.
Well, that will be interesting. Sherilyn Cabrera is WLRN's senior producer. Sherry, many thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, is there really such a thing as college football anymore, or just money? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. This was the moment that broke every University of Miami fan's heart Monday night here at Hard Rock Stadium. Indiana University's Jamari Sharp intercepted a last-minute pass by Hurricanes quarterback Carson Beck to seal the Hoosiers' first-ever national football championship. The Hurricanes have yet to win one since 2001. Still, both UM and IU fans are riding high on their football program's epic revivals. But there's a sobering question behind that gridiron delirium. Is what those fans are rooting for today really college football? Or are these just millionaire professional mercenaries dressed up as student athletes, switching teams more often than NFL free agents do? Sure, student athletes long deserve the revenue sharing and other money makers they're allowed today. But Carson Beck, who doesn't attend classes at UM, drives a Lamborghini. So why do our universities endorse what might be a charade? What do you think? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie, who engaged those questions in a report for us this week. Carlton, how are you?
Great, Tim. Good to be here.
Okay, let's go straight to the heart of what's turned college football into this quasi-professional arrangement we've got today. Let's be honest. College football has historically had a corruption problem, including UM back in the 1990s. And as I mentioned, it's generally recognized as a good thing that these student athletes can now get a share of all the big college sports money they help generate. Although I think a lot of low-income engineering students would love to have the full-ride scholarships that many student athletes get. But what are the big changes in recent years that have brought college football to this money-is-everything state? In particular, revenue sharing and that thing called NIL.
Right. We're talking about player compensation. Yeah. So NIL stands for name, image, and likeness. This basically means that while you're a collegiate athlete, you can make money on your name, your image, or your likeness, whether that's appearing in a commercial for the local car dealership or, like Quinn Ewers and Cade Klubnik have done, appeared in a national Dr. Pepper advertisement.
Okay.
Those things used to be illegal, and there were severe penalties for athletes that engaged in that. There was a big scandal at LSU maybe 10 or 15 years ago where that happened. The other thing you mentioned is revenue sharing. This is new. NIL's been around since 2021, but a lawsuit called House versus NCAA that was filed or resolved, I should say, last year now means that schools have to share the revenue of their football program with their players. This is the first time that schools have paid players directly from their own checkbooks.
Right.
NIL was done by outside parties, and while there were some that were affiliated, Miami had a very famous NIL cooperative that was headlined by John Ruiz, the billionaire founder of LifeWallet, where he signed over 100 Miami athletes to commercials.
Right.
But now the University of Miami is writing part of those checks, and for a lot of the college football programs, it's somewhere, it's like $21 million this year that they are distributing out to their team. So the players are not just making money on their name, but now off the revenue that their sport drives.
Right. But those universities then are not themselves looking to for other sources of those funds that they need to be able to share those revenues with students, right?
Well, they've got $21 million they got to make up, Tim.
Right.
So they've got to go back out to those boosters that were funding these NIL collectives to now ask them to basically supplement the university's revenue sharing
loss. And as you point out in your reporting, in Indiana University's case, that source is
Mark Cuban.
Billionaire Mark Cuban. And in University of Miami's case, it was
John Ruiz,
who you just mentioned before. Okay, so we've got this cycle going then. Tell us about, though, the billionaire patronage, for example, that the two teams we watched Monday night playing for the national championship, IU and UM, now rely on to be contenders. How does that dynamic, in IU's case with Mark Cuban and UM's case with Mr. Ruiz, how does that work?
Well, you mentioned the way that Cuban has funded Indiana. He had funded programs at Indiana before. He gave them a sports broadcasting center, I think, in like 2014 or 15.
Right.
But in the last 2 years, including just recently, he's made gifts specifically to the athletics department.
Right.
That's allowed them to be more aggressive and pursue transfers like Fernando Mendoza, the Heisman Trophy winner.
Who came from Miami, right.
And so that kind of just gives the schools the ability. It's also a great recruiting tool because if you're the head of, you know, booster services at IU, it's a very easy pitch to go out and say, hey, Mark Cuban's investing in us.
Right, and not just Mark Cuban, like John Mellencamp, the big singing star who your generation probably does not remember because it's what I listened to in college. So anyway, so has this created a sort of snowball effect, though, or maybe an arms race is the better analogy, where schools need to keep shelling out more and more money to student athletes under this new legal situation, and in turn need to keep generating more and more billionaire donor largesse to remain competitive?
I think arms race is really apt because the assured destruction is if you don't play. It's not about, you know, do you need to pay every single player to be a successful college football program? I mean, theoretically, no, but practically, yes, right? If you're Indiana, Ohio State and Michigan are about to open their coffers to spend and angle for transfers or, you know, prized high school recruits. Schools like Miami have a real advantage, not just because of the program history, but there's a lot of influencer activity that goes on in Miami, and it gives kids an opportunity to kind of step into making their own money through NIL compensation.
There's the Ocean Drive cachet,
USC and UCLA have a great advantage being in Los Angeles, being able to tell kids they could get NIL deals like that. So you are forced to play that hand. Otherwise, it's not just about how big the weight room is or if you've got a jacuzzi for after practice or the nicest meals that you can provide a student or where they'll get drafted. You kind of have to give them value now on the front end or they probably won't choose your school.
So as I said, it's sort of a self-perpetuating cycle then. But there's another facet to this that critics also point to, and that's the infamous transfer portal, the system wherein college players can just pick up and leave a school for another school's football program, even during the playoffs when a team might need that player most. I mean, I think this is where that feeling that college football players have just become millionaire mercenaries tends to arise, no?
Well, there are limits on the transfer portal. They can only declare during certain times. And you
the
mentioned,
window, as it's called. Yeah,
yeah, you mentioned players leaving during the playoffs. Well, that's something coaches do and have done forever. Lane Kiffin, the head coach at Ole Miss, left the school right before they were going to go on their college football playoff run.
But we don't think of coaches, though, as student athletes. There's a difference there, though. You think of the student athlete as, I don't know, am I being too naive or archaic here in my thinking?
I think that's the idea, right? It's not often these, you know, Fernando Mendoza is not going to put his finance degree to work. He's going to go be the number one pick in the NFL draft.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just
so
not
we're just being honest about that then. Yeah.
I think that's the thing, right? The money has made this transparent. As you have you mentioned, right? This corruption, the paying players has gone back forever. I mean, almost every big football program has had at least some scandal where it found out a player was getting an improper benefit or their family was getting an improper benefit. So it's just kind of brought this all out in the light. And I think we're having a little bit more of an honest discussion about what these players actually represent, because they do. I mean, the University of Texas makes like $1 billion a year off their football program.
But we should also mention just quickly, Fernando Mendoza's little brother, who was his backup at IU, has suddenly transferred this week over to Georgia Tech, right?
Well, can you blame him, Tim? Indiana just signed Josh Hoover, the quarterback from TCU, who was the most highly prized transfer quarterback. So Mendoza thought he wasn't going to start.
No,
you might as well.
But how does all this affect, if not perhaps degrade, the idea that this is really college football we're watching now, Carlton? I mean, I mentioned earlier the fact that millionaire Hurricanes quarterback Carson Beck does not even attend classes at UM. His biggest concern isn't his grade point average, but his Lamborghini insurance premiums. So how do we define today the actual relationship between universities and their football players?
Well, and don't downplay it, because those insurance premiums went up when his Lamborghini was
stolen right
last February. But I think, like we mentioned about just being more honest and transparent, the athletics programs are in a lot of ways the marketing arm for universities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just it's the front door into a lot of the other stuff the university does. I know that after Florida State won its national championship when I was there in 2013, applications rose the next year. It's just the reality of the situation. If your athletics program is better and more prominent, then your school is going to get these kind of downstream effects just by the virtue of the spotlight being placed on it.
Yeah, I want to explore that a little bit here in just a second. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Carlton Gillespie about whether college football, including the national championship runners-up University of Miami Hurricanes, is really college football anymore, or just millionaire pros dressed up as student athletes. And if so, why do our universities go along with it? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. All right, let's go back to that, Carlton. You mentioned earlier that this situation is not confined to football, obviously. College basketball, men's and women's, is also part of the new money-soaked reality. How are universities, though, and by that I mean the higher education mission, benefiting from this quasi-professional college sports reality today? And just as an aside, I would point out that the University of Miami cracked the top 50 of U.S. News & World Report's national university rankings a couple decades ago when the football program was at a low point. Today, when football is riding high again, UM is ranked number 64. I'm not making a link there. I'm just asking, is a top-flight football team that important to the university?
It's what you do with the asset, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's undeniable that a top football team is good for your school, you know, in marketing, in monetarily, but it's an asset that you have to invest in. And I talked to some officials from Indiana earlier this week before the game kicked off, and they're very conscious that this spotlight, like for many college football programs, it doesn't last forever. I mean, look at Alabama, who was an undefeatable juggernaut for 15 years. And as soon as Nick Saban's left, they've taken a significant step back. So it's important for those schools that want to do this. They need to capitalize on whenever the football team gets mentioned, and the guys from Indiana will tell you this, we have a top 10 business school or a top medical program. Right. We surpassed $1 billion in research funding. Are these things that the football program opened up? Maybe, maybe not, but it is kind of the, like I said, the front door to get in and sell the rest of the university.
We should also point out that the president of Indiana University during the playoffs wrote an op-ed for the New York Times essentially admitting that the university is following the football program's model now in terms of how to develop for the future. That struck me as a bit strange.
Yes, but in a vacuum, the football program is the best in the country. So it's not a bad idea to copy whatever model they used create that.
Now, I also wanted to ask you real quickly about the effect that the whole power conference phenomenon today is affecting the college football experience, especially for fans. I mean, conferences used to have regional characters and really fun regional rivalries, but now they just seem to have expedient revenue-generating characters. What role are they, like the Atlantic Coast Conference or ACC that UM belongs to, how are they playing a role in this?
Well, the college football landscape has kind of shifted. You know, they're used to, like you mentioned, there were regional conferences, the SEC, the Big 12, the Big 10, the Pac-12. The Pac-12 doesn't have, was the Pac-10, then the Pac-12. Now there's only like two or three teams in it. They've kind of been picked because these programs, in search of prestige, in search of revenue, have joined these more prestigious concerts, whether it's the former Big Ten or the SEC, because that's the way that you're going to get in. If you want to go play for a national championship, you have to take your rivals off the schedule and play tougher teams. That's why, you know, Miami and Florida have played recently because it's a good matchup, but it's not something that's guaranteed into the future like it once was.
Yeah.
Now they'll always play Florida State as long as they're in the same conference. But again, Florida State has talked multiple times about wanting to jump conferences and move.
Now, finally, in just the minute we have left here, what's next for college athletics then, Carlton? It seems we are in a Wild West period for the sport now, but what are the efforts made to rein in this spending?
Well, something will happen. There's a lot of motivation on Capitol Hill from both Republicans and Democrats. There was an article in The Hill about this just a few days ago that cited both Elizabeth Warren and Tommy Tuberville, a former college football coach, both agreeing that something needs to be done to rein this in. There was the SCORE Act that was tried to pass a few years ago, but nothing happened there. So we'll see, but there's a lot of momentum.
This could be some legislative action then. Okay. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Carlton, many thanks as always.
Happy to be here, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, given the issue Carlton Gillespie and I just discussed, we were struck this week by an opinion article in the University of Miami student newspaper, The Hurricane. It was written by student journalist Alex Arepetov, a 21-year-old economics major. In it, he argues that, quote, college athletics are losing their core identity in this new money-soaked era of college football, especially with the creation of those power conferences we just mentioned that have trashed regional rivalries like UM versus UF that fans cherished. As Arepetov told South Florida Roundup producer Jimena Romero,
in the era of NIL, I really thought it was important to write this because big schools such as Michigan or Miami, they have a lot of money. All the big talent goes to those schools while many of the smaller schools are left out.
Arepetov's reporting also points out that as power conferences require players to make more and more long cross-country trips for games, quote, missed lectures and exams make it increasingly difficult for student athletes to succeed in the classroom. The classroom, where students learn the kind of critical thinking Arepetov displayed in his Hurricane article. That's what matters at a university, not a football team. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.